Well, good morning and welcome to the Daily Connection here on KDUB. A little bit different music today. That was, in fact, inspired by one of our guests here. And, oh, it's just a guy we love a lot. It's Matt McAuliffe, who said, "Hey, do you have the Danse Macabre by Camille Saint-Saëns?" And I reached deep and I said, "You know what? You're in luck." The Danse Macabre there by Saint-Saëns. And we're going to be talking about, well, kind of death and destruction today. Matt's here with Chris, and we're going to do our monthly look at church history. And the topic for discussion this morning is one that really is often overlooked. It is the Black Death, just an incredible time in European history. Well, I guess it's not just Europe, but really kind of a worldwide sort of thing.
Amen.
But you guys, great to have you here again with the Danse Macabre.
Hey, good to be back here. And Matt and I both want to compliment you on your Halloween mask you're wearing.
It's grisly, isn't it?
Oh, wait a second. That's not your mask. We've been waiting for a month to say that.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I have the face for radio.
Yeah. So amen. And a voice for print, definitely.
Yes. So that's it. So, well, guys, good to have you back.
Good to be here, bro.
You know, the Black Death.
Yeah. What about the Black Death? You know, it's kind of funny. We actually have, almost all of us have in our childhood, a little verse that is related to the Black Death. You remember the little playground game we all did where we did Ring Around the Rosie as kids, you remember? And you dance around and fall down.
Yeah.
That's totally good impersonation.
Thank
I like that.
Was that a 6-year-old right there?
Yeah, that was a 6-year-old impersonation. Yeah, Ring Around the Rosie is absolutely related to the Black Death. The Ring Around the Rosie was going around the rosary beads, of course, for prayer.
Okay.
And then pocket full of posies. The people had a belief that such as from flowers or from herbs and resins and all that would ward off the Black Death, and so they carried a little nosegay with them to protect them against the Black Death. Ashes was because people were dying so fast. They had nearly 13,000 people dying a day. The churches were so overwhelmed with bodies to bury. The church graveyards had long been filled up. They were filling up open trenches, and finally they had to just start doing bonfires and burning the bodies to stay up on it. Then we all fall down was the idea. Well, the bottom line is no one seems to be able to escape this. And so, hence the poem, Ring Around the Rosie. So,
how did you find that out?
Oh, well, we have our sources, that's for sure.
Okay.
So anyway, you know, why do a show about the Black Death?
Because it's Halloween, right?
No, not because it's Halloween.
Oh,
but because it not only profoundly affected the history of the world, but also the history of the church.
Well, you know, Pat, normally you and Christopher and I, we require that people attend our PBC history class in order that we divulge the closely guarded secret of which year was the worst in human history.
Uh-huh.
But we're going to tap some pity on the radio listening public and let them know that that was the year 1350 around which the plague happened. Now, for China, it was just a few years earlier. But here's the thing. In the middle of the 14th century, call it 1340 or something like that, people are starting to hear the merchants that run the Silk Routes through Asia are starting to hear really bizarre rumors about something going on in China. You know, millions of deaths and earthquakes, fire, pestilence, volcano. And, you know, they're kind of wandering around going, "Whoa, that's a bummer. I'm glad we don't live there." Well, there in Crimea, in the Black Sea, above what is now Istanbul, in 1347 shows up the beginnings of the plague. And it's the Mongols who are there are just panicking, and they're trying to get into the fort that the Genoese Italian merchants keep there as a trading outpost. Well, the Italian merchants close the door. They're scared, too. And so the Mongols begin to catapult the dead bodies of their own people over the walls into the fort. This is, by the way, the first known use of biological warfare. And, of course, the Genoese are affected. And they leap in their ships and they go sailing home to Sicily and Genoa. And lo and behold, there is the birth of the bubonic plague.
Oh, and so they had the disease on the ships on the way.
Oh, yeah. It didn't take anything. We won't do a lot about the epidemiology, the clinical information about the plague. It was really confusing because there were several types. One type actually was transferred from the fleas that carried on the rats on the ship. to humans. There were other types that were airborne. You know, if somebody coughed or breathed on you, you'd get it. There were types you could get from the touching the dead person's clothes. So that was one of the things that added to the confusion and helped make it impossible for the doctors to use what little knowledge they had at those times to do anything about it. So anyway, you've got the plague, 1347. It hits the coastal cities of Italy, and for the next 4 years, just proceeds to march north at 10 miles a day, and within 4 years has engulfed Europe.
Wow.
And just, well, and just imagine the terror of this, being a peasant in the German lowlands and hearing, and it's just getting closer and closer and closer. What do you do? Where do you go?
Yeah, it's marching forward. Mm-hmm. This plague, there was basically three main strains of it. One had, if you had the bubonic plague, it had a 40% survival rate. If you had one of the other two strains, you had one that had 100% mortality rate after 2 days. And then there was a third kind, the very worst kind, had a 100% mortality rate within 1 to 2 hours.
Oh my gosh.
And one of the writers of the time said that many people had lunch with their family at noon and had supper with their ancestors in heaven that night. That's how incredible this was and how it affected society.
Pretty terrifying.
Well, what was it like to live during the plague? What was going on at the time, and how did this affect people? Well, people thought it was the end of the world. I mean, they really did. I mean, you had, you know, of course, what you heard going on in Asia, but all of Europe was just absolutely falling apart. One of the things that was common was to find ships adrift at sea, fully loaded,
really?
Empty,
everybody
dead on this. You know, the ships are just, you know, bobbing up. There's nothing, you know, it's like weird things going on. Food shortages. There's no one to plant or harvest because people are dying off so fast. Cattle are just roaming and going wild because of the fact that there's no one to tend to them. And a total breakdown in law and order. You know, it's very easy to have a breakdown in law and order whenever there's a huge panic situation, but then when the normal forms of order in law enforcement are dying at a rate faster than they can even replace them, there's a complete and total breakdown in society. And, of course, one of the big things is the psychological breakdown on people. Normal things, you know, of common decency, familial ties, marital covenants, all that sort of thing, kind of went out the window.
Oh,
people,
man,
just said, you know, this is it. I'm leaving my family. I'm leaving my wife. I'm running. I've got to escape this. You know, just a total breakdown of even what we call common decency in the mind. People live for today. If they had any food, they would just gorge on it and just eat it because they had no idea of planning for tomorrow.
It was very common, even, you know, the first sign of sickness in a child or a father or a wife or a brother, you know, you'd cover that person with a blanket, you'd put some water and food by their bedside table, and you'd tell them, you know, I'm just going to run for the doctor, and never come back.
They'd never come back. They just abandon the sick in their homes. Actually, in Milan, Italy, if they found out somebody was sick, they would actually come and board them and the entire family up in the house or brick it up so that they would actually quarantine them, and they just kill everybody in the house, whether they were sick or not, just to try to protect, you know, try to protect the rest of the population. One of the other things, of course, was the fact that people's tastes in art and music actually moved towards the macabre. Prior to the Black Death, people had real cheerful, joyful singing and mirthful music. After the Black Death, people really got into mournful, somber, weird music and art forms. People painted pictures of people dancing with skeletons and corpses, and it just very, very bizarre.
The picture of the Grim Reaper that we have even today dates from this period. And it became very common in any painting for a figure of skeletal death to be there somewhere in the painting. Sort of like, where is Elmo?
Exactly. Yeah, only we're looking for the Grim Reaper instead of the little guy there. Well, at the end of this 5-year period, the year of the European plague, it seems to lose momentum, probably because it thinned enough people out there.
I guess.
You know, it just couldn't spread as fast anymore. But there were sporadic breakouts for another 200 years throughout Europe. But at the end of this time period, 25 million people were killed. And that equals out, I did the math on that equals one person every 6.5 seconds for 5 years.
And I have to say, at this point, Chris is actually giving you a very conservative figure. I mean, that's about the lowest figure anybody agrees on. It may have been as many as 40 or 50 million. And it's not even the amount so much as the percentages. I mean, it was up to perhaps half of the population of Europe and China a few years before that. It was just, it took until the 19th century for Europe to reach its pre-plague population levels. It wasn't until the time of the American Civil War that towns like London and Paris and Vienna had their pre-plague population levels restored.
1350 to 1850, the same population after the plague.
After the plague. Think about that in modern-day terms. That's really kind of unbelievable. So how did this affect history, Matt?
Well, by golly, it had quite a few effects. Chris will be talking about some of the spiritual effects in a minute, but right off the bat, some of the instant things that happened were, boom, all of a sudden, you have almost no labor force left. It's good if you happen to survive. You know, you, for the first time, the serfs that in the decaying forms of feudal Europe, the serfs actually had some say-so. And some mobility. They said, well, you know, I don't have to work for you for 2 kopecks a day because I can go over to this other lord. He doesn't have any workers. He'll pay me 3 kopecks a day. This had never happened before. And the government's kind of clamped down on it. They didn't like it. They weren't trying to be cruel. They were just trying to keep a lid on this situation. And you had the eruption of several peasants' revolts. And everything. So that was one. Many people think that the stimulation of technology that characterized a lot of the Renaissance came from this need to make up for such a lack in labor. One of the other social effects was a complete moral breakdown, you know, that Christopher talked about. Well, that wasn't just during the panic. I mean, that was actually, that continued on and on. Who knows? Maybe that stimulated the free thought that led to the Renaissance, even the Enlightenment. But a gross immorality, huge upsurge in crime, violence. I mean, organized gangs actually wore red masks, red capes, and went around pillaging, raping, plundering, looting. It was unbelievable. One of the interesting things, people focused on fashion. Fashion was a consuming passion.
As well as entertainment.
Yeah.
There was a market that developed because people, they just needed to have entertainment to occupy their minds, and you know, they felt like, well, who knows how long I'm going to live? So they filled themselves with folly, and a lot of novels and that sort of thing started developing.
Very interesting, almost a cultural psychosis, almost a cultural denial. As a matter of fact, there were really three reactions to this. One was the complete the hysteria and denial, and just go off and act, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The other was extremism that we'll talk a little bit later about. But one I wanted to mention was in a very low percentage of the population, very, very heroic service to their fellows. And the two groups that really shined out in this were the religious monastic community, the monks, the nuns, and the priests, and the best doctors. These were the folks that went, and they went and ministered to the hopeless that were dying. And as a result, they died. While the scumbag religious people and the scumbag doctors all took off and hid, the best ones went in and did their job and died. And after, you know, that's after the plague, Europe has ministering to its medical and religious needs, the scrapings from the bottom of the barrel.
You know, one of the other things that certainly was a change was the fact that in Europe at the time, the two main languages that were taught and spoken were French and Latin. And so many people died that there was they quit teaching. They quit teaching French and Latin. There weren't anybody around to teach it. And so what happened was, is you began seeing the rise of vernacular languages, such as English, such as German, such as Spanish, such as Italian, and all that. Those began because there was no one to continue the tradition of teaching the classic French and Latin to people. And so that's how there was the rise of all the different vernacular languages, a direct result of the plague.
But totally apart from the effects on social effects on the church as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, probably the big thing that happened was the fact that it led to a great spiritual questioning going on in people's mind. You know, the church had lost many leaders and members. Monasteries stood empty. And many people were asking why God and the church could not use their power to stop this plague. And so this became a time of great questioning in many people's minds and hearts. And some have argued that this produced really the sea change that helped open the door to the Reformation down the road. And then, of course, there was another curious reaction from the spiritual side called the Flagellant Brethren.
Mm-hmm. You know, and even before I touch on those guys, I want to remind everybody that it wasn't just the plague that led to this spiritual reexamination. My gosh, this is like the time when we had two popes, the Babylonian captivity.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the Hundred Years' War between France and England, armies roaming up and down northern Europe, slaughtering, you know, raping, pillaging, burning. This was not a good time.
Learning how to build cannons,
killing
with longbows.
You bet. You bet. It was really bad news. So anyway, one of the extreme forms of reaction was people thought, well, we'll placate God's wrath. And one of the growths was a movement called the Flagellant Brethren. These are guys, you know, that you've seen in the Monty Python movies, you know, where they're beating themselves, they're wandering in a big, long, single-file line, beating themselves with sticks and whips, and in hopes to appease God's wrath. Well, you know, it started out probably as a very sincere thing, but it didn't take long for it to get into just a real complete wacko movement. These guys would wander from village to village, city to city, and they were like living martyrs almost. And so they really started getting full of themselves. When they arrived at a town, they'd take over the church or the cathedral, start giving orders. If anybody, you know, said anything against them, they would condemn that person. And, you know, people were killed and burned. It was really weird. And the problem was they led to probably the worst persecution of the Jews in this period. And just let's give a thumbnail sketch there. We've never done really well with the Jews in terms of our witness as the body of Christ. But initially, in the Middle Ages, the Jews were the only ones who could charge interest. And so they developed into the bankers and financiers of Europe. And it was really, they were the only ones that could do it, and they were encouraged by Charlemagne and those. Well, during the Middle Ages, the, like Venice and Genoa, some of the merchant communities began to compete with them. They just began to do a good job of banking and financing on their own. Competition increased. A lot of the Jews were kind of went down to the pawnbroker street shark loan level. Mm-hmm. And so frankly, you've got not only royal resentment building against them, but popular resentment as well. And so when something bad like this happens, all of a sudden you've got one more excuse to get those darn Jews, you know, who crucified the Lord. And even though Pope Clement VI really, boy, he put out a lot of pronouncements and proclamations getting people to stop this, boy, oh boy, they just, 10,000 Jews per city really were killed. Hundreds of communities were exterminated even before the plague arrived. One of the interesting things was the Jews, because they keep kosher, they go and they get running water for their water supply. Mm-hmm. Well, this led, even though they'd always done this, this led people to say, well, it's because they poisoned our wells. That's why they go get running water.
And the rumor mill actually spread from one end to Europe to the other. It was quite an amazing thing about this.
Gosh.
But it's just an interesting phenomena when the going gets rough that the Jews have a tendency to be scapegoats. That happened in the Crusades. It's happened time and time and time again. Happened in World War II once again. A big scapegoating on. So
we always find those guys. And you didn't have to be Jewish. A leper's suffered. All you had to be was a stranger, and you would suffer. But the Jews took the brunt of it, even though they were dying at the same rate.
Another thing that, on a more positive note, was the fact that there was kind of a reprioritization in a lot of people's minds and hearts. The accumulation of wealth became totally a non-priority. I mean, people just didn't care. They knew that their money would do them no real good against this. And so a lot of people really kind of became way less materialistic in a very good way. And another thing was that there was a lot of movement in the idea of forgiving past wrongs, past debts, that sort of thing, in people's hearts as well. They knew, hey, life is short. They recognize the brevity of life, and so they were not people willing to carry long lists of grudges and debts and wrongs against them. And then, of course, there was, you know, a real soul searching in a lot of people. You know, was this and is this the divine retribution of God against us? I mean, you know, there were some people throughout the whole plague that, you know, they never got over the idea that it was a disease. They really did think it was divine retribution. But the Pope and quite a few other leaders, they really did look at this and say, no, this is a disease. They had no idea what was causing it. Medicine at the time absolutely did not have the knowledge to work with.
Nothing seemed to prevent it.
And the best minds in the best as a matter of fact, the best minds in the world were at University of Paris, and their idea was the fact that Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars were in alignment, and thus they were causing an unfortunate pull on the Earth's gravitational force, which released poisonous gases, and thus we were just merely in an unfortunate astronomical position at the time.
And the NASDAQ was down 20 points. It was bad. You know,
it was pretty amazing. One of the other voices at this time is someone, a name that many people are familiar with, is John Wycliffe.
You know, when we talk about did the Black Death bring about the spiritual resolution that fueled the Reformation, you can get into a lot of arguments with this. But, you know, frankly, just looking at it, here is 18-year-old John Wycliffe watching this happen. The man who...
In England then, too.
Everywhere.
Some places more, some places less, but sooner or later the plague found you, got you, was untouched. You knew somebody, probably a lot of people, that had died. But, picture, half your church, half your family, half your village, half the Rogue Valley. Basically, if that's what you picture, then half the people you knew are dead. So here's John Wycliffe, a young teenager. You ask yourself, did that motivate this guy to think seriously about translating the Bible into the common tongue to put into the hands of the common people? Well, I'm going to put my dollar on that. That's my guess, and I think it galvanized a lot of the reformers. Basically, they realized, you know what? A church is not going to save me. A church is not my mediator between God. Only Christ and my relationship with Christ is going to satisfy. And I think it opened up a whole new threshold for human understanding of the relationship with God. So that's my bet.
And interesting notion, yeah.
And wouldn't you also say that one of the things that, as far as a lesson for us today in all this, is that we need to realize that a lot of times our disillusionment that we have with the Lord is caused from a false notion that our relationship with Christ is going to spare us from the tragedies of life and the tragedies of history. And, you know, there's a flow. We have our own lives, but then also we're caught up in a bigger story going on. And it would seem that, you know, if you take a long view of history at any time, that God does not spare us from that. Many good people and Christian people are caught up in things that are so far beyond their control. And what God calls us to do is to be faithful to Him. That is the main thing. Not to be spared like a good luck charm, but to be faithful to the Lord through those crises.
Like the good doctors and priests and monks, it's almost, the best ones went in and died, it's almost as if the Lord wanted them out of the way and took the faithful out of the situation, let things just degenerate horribly so that the Reformation would come about. Who knows? But great point, Christopher. We've got to trust, no matter what it looks like on the outside, no matter how it seems to our perceptions, God knows what He's doing. Relax. He's going to get it there.
Membership in the church, I guess, just does not insulate you from
that. No, I'm afraid not.
From that. Interestingly, well, Pat, just one real quick thing. I know we're almost out of time, but, you know, the plague is still with us today.
Amen.
And as a matter of fact, there's an area in the United States bigger, in the western United States, bigger than the area that was affected in Europe, in which the rodent population has the bubonic plague. And every year, there are a few people that they're usually outdoor recreationists that even though there is a cure for this and now an injection and things that could help you, that they die of the plague because they're so far in the wilderness they can't get out in time. But the plague is something that is still around and is probably one of the longest running things, but it's not really something in past history. It's something that even continues to this very day.
I'm glad we didn't discuss the symptoms.
Okay. Matt, Chris, Lord bless you guys. Thanks for that really fascinating discussion, bubonic plague here. And you know, we're going to do another show in another month and... probably on a lighter topic. But anyway, Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, both on staff at Trail Christian Fellowship. I'm Pat Daly. Lord bless you today.